Welcome to the Pragmatic Podcast for May 7th, 2008, Pragmatic Publishing.
I think you have to have pride in what you do. I mean, there's only so many hours in a day, and if you're doing stuff that you're not proud of, then, you know, that kind of sucks.
That's Dave Thomas, also known as Pragmatic Dave. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and this week I talked to Dave about how things work around here. He and Andy Hunt began to publish books after their experience writing The Pragmatic Programmer for Addison Wesley a little more than 10 years ago. They actually did most of the work for that book.
We did the layout. We actually produced basically a camera-ready PostScript file that we sent to Addison Wesley. So we did pretty much all of the work necessary apart from the actual printing to get Pragmatic Programmer out. And then a year later, we did the same thing with the first version of the Pickaxe books, Programming Ruby. So we thought we knew a fair amount about the actual mechanics of getting a book ready to go out. And then we went back to our regular kind of, you know, day jobs of consulting and the rest. Around about 2001, I guess, we found ourselves in the situation where we were doing a lot of work trying to help teams get software out the door. And almost without exception, those teams had problems. And the problems were fundamentally due to the fact they didn't have the basics in place. They were scrambling around worrying about architecture and, you know, the finer points of this and that. But they weren't actually storing their source in a version control system. They weren't testing their software as they wrote it. And they weren't automating their processes. We actually had one client that had 15 different developers, and no two developers could actually build the same software because the configurations on each of their machines was different. So we decided that we wanted to write a series of three books on automation, testing, and version control. At the time, it was CVS. We thought about going back through Addison Wesley to do that. But then we realized, you know, we actually have all the skills we need to do this in-house. So why don't we publish it for ourselves? So we did that. We produced the starter kit. We found a printer. It all went very well. So kind of we fell into being a publisher. It wasn't a deliberate decision that we were going to take on the world. It's just something that we knew how to do and we were kind of driven to do. We weren't that happy with a lot of the books that were around at the time, and we kind of thought we could do it better.
Is your publishing process designed for people like you, people who are willing to do all that up to pretty much camera ready?
Absolutely not. We really want our authors to concentrate solely on content. In fact, I would say that compared to the traditional publisher, we actually ask our authors to be considerably less involved in issues such as layout. With most publishers, you are laying out the book either using probably something like Microsoft Word or possibly a tool like FrameMaker. And both with Word and FrameMaker, you are looking at the stuff you type as if it was the final book. Now, the reality is it's not, but it's very hard to get over the illusion that you're looking at a galley that contains you know, all the layout, all the tables, all the figures. You know, you're worried about line breaks, paragraph breaks, and that's irrelevant. When at the point you're actually writing a book, that's the very last thing you want to concentrate on. So we do it in two steps. When you write a book with us, you actually write it using a very simple markup language. It's XML-based, but it's very, very trivial. You don't worry about layout. You don't actually even see the layout necessarily as you're typing it. So instead, you focus on the content. The other idea is that our layout is logical markup as opposed to physical markup. So you never say, make this text bold or make this text italic. Instead, you say, this is a keyword in my programming language, or this is the name of a variable. And then our production system will map that to the appropriate representation. It may be emboldened in a paper book, and it may be in a different color in a online PDF. So you're writing always at this logical level and not worrying about things like layout. But I know that people want to see the laid out book. So we also run a continuous build system so that if you cannot actually process the book locally on your computer, you can always go to the continuous build system and have a look to see what it's going to look like in the final form. One of the fun things about that is that if you go to a traditional publisher and you write your book in Word, and when you finish the book, you hand over the .doc file or whatever it might be, and they will take that and give it to somebody who will then convert it into probably something like FrameMaker or InDesign. So your original doc file is then obsolete. The master copy is the one that they typeset, and that's a FrameMaker document. Which means that as an author, you've lost access to your book. It's now in the hands of the publisher. We actually typeset directly from the markup that you create. So when you edit one of our files, that's the file that we actually use to produce the typeset version. When it goes through our continuous build system, it actually typesets it exactly the same way it will when we send it to the printer. And that means that you can actually see what the end user will see, what the reader will see, as you're going along writing the book, if you really want to.
So one of the things I like is, you know, I've written for other publishers using that Word sort of chain, and you pass it off to an editor who also is using Word but has all the autocorrect turned on. And the next thing you know, your code has been spell checked and grammar checked, and your mains now are in caps because they follow a period. Here we keep the code separate. The code is code.
Absolutely. When we wrote the Ruby book, there are over, I think, 1,200 code extracts in that Ruby book. And at the time, Ruby was changing. And the last thing that we wanted to do was to sit there and have to go through and work out, you know, what we had to change in a massive, massive manuscript. So instead, we wrote a very simple preprocessor, which allowed us to keep our code in external files and then include that code into the book as it was formatted. And in fact, in the case of the Ruby book, not only do we include the code, we could actually run the code as the book was being formatted and insert the output of that run into the book as well. So in the Ruby book, when it says A equals 1, B equals 2, A plus B, and then you see the annotation is 3 next to that, that 3 is actually being calculated every single time we format the book. So if Ruby changes, the book changes automatically.
This came up in a cool way. I just edited Venkat's Groovy book, and he's a test first kind of guy. And so all of his code that was in the book also had unit tests. And so when Groovy changed versions, he saw from the tests which things changed and what he had to change in the book to accommodate the changes to the language.
Having the code in external files, and more importantly, having those external files runnable and testable is crucial. And so I think we get a pretty low error rate in the code in our books, because we pretty much insist that all that code is runnable and it's all external. It also gives us some other nice things as well. So, for example, we get syntax highlighting for free because the tool that embeds the code into our documents also syntax highlights it on the way in.
And honestly, there's going to be errors in any book. And one of the things that's been nice is the beta program lets some of the readers help us catch some of the problems before we have a printed version.
Yeah, actually, the interesting thing about that was the motivation for the beta program was exactly the opposite. Andy and I are both programmers, and we really wanted to produce books for programmers, books that were actually useful. One of the problems with book publishing is that with the best will in the world, there's a 6 month to 1 year minimum time to get a book out from conception to paper. So we thought, well, what would happen if we took the books that we were writing and basically exposed them to the readers as we were writing them? And the benefit we saw was that readers would be able to get content early and therefore make use of the book. And we kind of trusted that they'd know that the stuff they were seeing early on was pretty rough and it would probably have mistakes and it would certainly be ugly compared to the final book, but it would give them content. What we hadn't realized was how interactive that process would end up being. The first book we did that on, we got over 1,000 comments, observations, bug reports come back through our errata system. And those 1,000 reports all made it into the final book.
One of the things that makes working here in a way simpler is you guys have a clear vision. The goal is simple. We're here to make developers' lives easier, make developers' lives better. And if this doesn't meet that goal, we don't publish that one.
Yeah, that's right. It's a really, really tough job. The work that developers do is really one of the harder jobs on the planet, because every day the developer is faced with thousands of decisions, from simple ones like, how do I name this variable, to complex ones like, you know, do I really need this functionality? And those decisions really weigh down on you. After a long day of coding, you are physically tired. I would like to do whatever I can to help developers get through their day and actually enjoy it. That's one of the things I love about Ruby, is that people using Ruby tend to smile. To me, that's a critical component of programming. You have to enjoy what you're doing to do it well. So we try to produce books to help people enjoy what they're doing more.
So you talked a bit about the tools, but you said you really want the authors thinking about the content. What is it that makes a book a Prag book and not a book that we published by someone else?
Andy's wife, Ellie, first introduced us to the concept of the Dreyfus model of skills acquisition. It's a fairly well-established now model, came out of the, I guess, early 70s. They talk about how people go through stages when they acquire knowledge, when they acquire skill. At the early stages, people really are interested in primarily achieving a goal. If you've never jumped out of an airplane before, then you don't really care about the theory of aerodynamics. You just want to know when to pull the ripcord. You want to be told what to do. But as you get more and more experience, as you get deeper into a subject, that's no longer satisfying. Instead, what you're doing is you're building an intuition. You're building tacit knowledge until you get to the point where you're an expert. And there's this interesting phenomena where experts pretty much work from intuition alone. Quite often, an expert cannot tell you why they believe a certain thing. They just know passionately that they believe it. One of the things we try to do in our books is to follow that. So that if you read most of our books, you'll find that at the start, we tend to be directive. We tend to say, now you want to do this, now you want to do that. But as the book progresses and as the reader gains more experience, then we'll tend to get more collegial. We'll tend to fall back on, you know, well, there's lots of different ways of doing this, and some of them are good and some of them are bad. You know, to some extent, you'll have to choose for yourself. So every one of our books is a journey where we try and help the reader go from being, I guess, a novice into being someone with more experience. And I think that's one of the things that sets our books apart. There's a conscious effort on the part of us and our editors to try and help authors construct a book in that kind of style. Another thing that makes our books, I think, is the voice. It's taken us a fair time to understand exactly what the voice is. We try very hard to be inclusive of the reader in our books. So we try very hard not to say, I, the author, do this and I, the author, do that. Instead, what we'd like to do is to imagine the author and the reader were sitting down together talking about whatever the subject was. And so typically, you'll be using we when you do things together. And sometimes, particularly in the beginning of the book, the author will be directing the reader, so they'll be saying you. But it's a more conversational tone than you get in most books.
You seem pretty comfortable blogging about this and talking about this. Is it that you're not worried about other publishers taking this on as well, or you'd like to see more of them take this on?
Oh, I would love to see more of them take this on. I don't feel in any way proprietary about this. I mean, I didn't invent, you know, the hero's journey. I didn't invent the Dreyfus model. I would love to see other publishers moving this way. I think that the paper book industry is in for a very rough time over the next 5-10 years. If you look at the booksellers, traditional booksellers, you'll find that they are dramatically reducing the space allocated to computer titles. You'll find that the channel is beginning to dry up for distribution. And I think that everything that publishers can do to improve the quality of their content will help keep the industry going. I'm not someone who can read a whole book in PDF form. I mean, PDFs are great for searching, they're great for reference, but you know, I cannot just sit in bed and read through a 300-page book on a laptop. I really want paper, and I want paper to survive. And I think a crucial part of paper surviving over the next 5 years is bringing up the quality of books to the point where readers just demand that, yes, I want this book and I want it on paper. Because if we can keep that going, then we can keep the industry alive for computer books.
That's hard. I heard Michael Kinsley on Bob Edwards' show the other day talk about the future of the newspaper industry. And he says, you know, in 10 years, he doesn't think we'll be printing newspapers. That this whole notion of cutting down forests to print newspapers, which are disposable every day, will go away. But books feel different.
I was actually just watching a Clay Shirky screencast from the Web 2.0 conference. And he was talking about how sitcoms were, he called it kind of like an intellectual heatsink. The idea was that maybe in the 50s, people started having a whole bunch of free time and they didn't know what to do with it. And in stepped television to say, here, I can use up your free time. You don't have to worry about it. And for the next 30, 40 years, a whole bunch of free time, he estimates something like a trillion hours a year of people's time was just spent basically watching television, so they didn't have to worry about what to do. And he's saying the transition is taking place now as people are starting to realize that that capital can be spent in other ways. Media, which is fundamentally just one way, is no longer going to work. The model used to work because people were looking for a diversion. They're looking for an outlet for that time. But now they've seen other ways of doing things. That's no longer going to be applicable. And I think the same applies to the book industry as well. I think that we're looking for an industry now which doesn't just produce books that, you know, plop down on your doorstep whenever the mailman arrives, or we don't just look at books that sit in the bookstore gathering dust, but instead we're looking for a more participatory way of doing things. And I think the beta book program that we came up with is baby steps towards that. The book is the community and vice versa. I think we maybe are looking for a way of producing a living book around a community. You could argue that wikis are doing that. But I think that publishers still have an important role to play in that. I think that publishers offer editorial ability. They offer the ability to get that content to people who may not be online. There's a whole bunch of stuff that as a publisher we can do.
Why can't anybody be a publisher?
Oh, they can. Absolutely they can. There's this lovely story at the beginning of the Pragmatic Programmer where someone walks up to the gardener at Eton College in England and says, you know, these lawns are lovely. I mean, how do I make a lawn that looks this good? And he says, oh, it's easy. I mean, all you have to do is to water it once a day. You have to weed it once every 3 days. Once a week, you have to roll it and make it look good. And then do that for 400 years. And they end up with a lawn that looks like this. Publishing isn't quite that bad. But I think a lot of people don't understand just how much time goes into a book. To produce a typical, maybe 250-page book probably takes in the order of, oh, I don't know, maybe 800 hours for the author, and probably about half of that, again, to get the thing actually out the door in terms of editorial support, indexing, copy editing, layout, everything else. So getting a book done is really, really a big deal. You can do it cheaper. You can do it cheaper by cutting corners. But fundamentally, there's a lot of work involved in a book. If you're prepared to do that work, we live in amazing times. I mean, you can get that book out there. You can put it on the net. You can do Pod through Amazon. You can do Pod through Lulu. Pod is print on demand. You just basically register a PDF file somewhere. And then when someone wants to buy the book, they go to the provider. The provider prints the book on demand from your PDF. So yeah, anybody can be a publisher. And I think that's great. We see examples of that. The Peep Code series, for example, from Jeffrey Grossenbach. They publish PDFs and they publish screencasts. And he started out by just saying, hey, I want to do this. And he did it. It's very easy for anyone to be a publisher. And I think that's a really exciting trend.
I think people that don't know think that, you know, you and Andy work in offices next to each other and you can pop in each other's office and have a cup of tea or coffee and talk things over. It's a widely distributed group.
I'm sitting here in my office above my garage right now. Andy has his office space. I think he may have moved it. It used to be above his garage. He may have moved it upstairs. I'm not too sure. And our editors are literally all over the country. Person that does our layout is we have people all over the world doing stuff. And it's very, very cool. It's also very, very challenging. It's not always the best. Every now and then I envy people that actually have offices. I can't believe I'm saying that. But there are some things that would be a lot easier to do if we were co-located. At the same time, the freedom and flexibility that we have from doing it the way we have is great, and I wouldn't change that for anything.
But then you do these off-the-wall things, like you say, well, editors should have accountability too, so we don't want you editing a book that you think should be canceled, so we're putting your name on the cover too, so it's your fault too. And I mean, it really changes things. It's just a little touch, but you think, do I want my name to go on this book or not?
I think you have to have pride in what you do. I mean, there's only so many hours in a day, and if you're doing stuff that you're not proud of, then, you know, that kind of sucks. So how do you know you're proud of something? Well, artists sign their work. So I think that, you know, if you're involved in a book production, you should do the same thing. And obviously the author gets their name on the cover. But I think the editor, people don't realize just how much effort or editors put in and what a thankless job it can be. So I think editors should get to sign their work too. And so starting about, I don't know, 6 months ago, all of our books now have the name of the editor on the cover. And that's simply to say thank you to the editor, and for the editor to know that, you know, what they do is appreciated.
If you didn't have 1,000 other things you had to do right now, what book would you be writing?
There are so many I would like to write. Right now, I am finishing off the third edition of The Pickaxe, the programming Ruby book. And I'm doing that really as a labor of love. It's really the only book that documents the Ruby API. And that's changed as of Ruby 1.9. So I just need to keep that fresh and keep that up to date. So that's my current big project. After that, I would like to write on functional programming languages. I think that they are probably the future of programming. Not in the next 2 years, but longer term. I would like to write a introductory text on functional programming and why it's important and how you do it. There's a crisis in software right now. People are not entering the industry. Enrollments are down across the universities. High school students, you're having a really tough time getting them to do the computer science electives. And that's one of those things where 10 years from now, we're going to look back and say, well, how could we possibly have let that natural resource slip out of our grasp? This country will no longer be competitive in software. We'll be buying all our software overseas, and we'll be worried about that. We'll be bitching about that. I would very much like to see more work being done to bring young people into software. And it's really not that hard, because I think if you present software development right, for a certain class of person, it's a really exciting opportunity. It's just never made to be exciting. When you teach it, you know, you're sitting there teaching about, you know, I think they still do C++ in the high schools here in Texas. And you just sit there and you talk about, oh, this is an integer, this is a pointer, blah, blah, blah. And it's never exciting. And so back in my mind, I would love to write a book for, I guess, high school students, maybe first year undergraduates, about how to program. But I want to try and get across why it's exciting to program, what the thrill of it is, and how doing it right just feels so good.
My to-do list includes something similar for mathematics, so I'm really glad to hear that.
If you spend your life doing something, it had better be a passion. And yet, most people find the passion only after going through periods of intense, you know, boredom and grief. You know, I had to do this at high school. I can't imagine how many people got turned off, for example, the beauty of mathematics, because they were taught badly at school. If you can find the right way of describing things, then you should be able to describe the passion that you feel and transfer that passion to a new generation of people coming through. And that's what I'd like to do for software, obviously what you'd like to do for mathematics. I think in almost every industry, you know, you find people who are passionate about things and ask them to communicate. And it may not always be, you know, fluent, but the idea that you can be passionate about something as abstract as mathematics and software is probably just so surprising to people that if you did it right, you know, they go, oh, maybe I should consider that.
That's Dave Thomas on the Pragmatic Podcast. Bit of a different show this week. If you'd like to read more, Dave wrote a multi-part series on writing books that you might want to read. You can navigate to it from pragprog.com, or you can head directly to pragdave.blogs.pragprog.com. You'll find our podcast at pragprog.com/podcasts, and you can join the discussion at forums.pragprog.com. The music for this podcast was composed and performed by Andy Hunt. For the Pragmatic Programmers, I'm Daniel Steinberg.